Blog.
Welcome to Peep State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peep State Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Peep State Pandemonium. We are back after a week off, and we are your hosts, the Georgia Gentlemen, Gary Oates and Bobby Simmons, and me, the Mobile Masher, Michael Norris. What are you guys up to this evening?
Well, I'd like to start off by saying, right before we went on there, I heard a reference to a mad dog in Jackson. Would that be Bobby Simmons?
I think it's his wife at this point.
Yeah. We're not foaming at the mouth yet, but we're getting close.
Oh, Lordy.
Well, guys, it's been a bad 2 weeks since we've been together as far as losses in the wrestling business. We've lost five in the last 2 weeks. First one we lost was a gentleman by the name of Robert Weathers, who I was not familiar with him, and I seriously doubt you two were, but he was a friend of ours, Ed Moretti's, his former tag team partner and friend. He worked under the name Bob Adonis, and also in Eastern Canada used the name Sonny Myers, because whoever the booker there was says he looked so much like the original Sonny Myers. But he passed away about a week and a half ago. Then after him, and this may be somebody, Jerry, that you crossed paths with, Woody Farmer, who was worked in Texas quite a bit, worked a lot on the East or the West Coast. I don't know if you ever crossed paths with him or not.
No, but my ex-brother-in-law trained him. He trained Woody.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
That's when Dickie was in San Francisco. I never met him. How old was he?
I don't know any of the details on any of these, because in looking, there was not really a whole lot out there as far as details or age or what they actually passed away from. Doug Parnas was another one. We lost him last Saturday. Found out while we were at the reunion that he passed away. There again, I don't know if you ever crossed paths with him. He was more in the 80s, primarily worked for Ford and around Knoxville, Tennessee area, because he was played football for the the Volunteers. So he,
Greg Brown met Doug when Greg went to Japan. Doug was on that tour, but I never met him.
Yeah, Doug was real big in Japan. Him and a guy named Phil LaFon were a big tag team over there. Then there was a gentleman by the name of Paul Figueroa, who primarily worked in the old WWWF, mainly doing opening card, TV jobs, stuff like that. But he was around quite a bit doing that. And the one that we all knew and was the closest to all of us was our friend Tommy Weathers, who refereed all over the place, Georgia, North Carolina, or the Tennessee, Knoxville, and Mobile, Kansas, Southeastern. Tommy died yesterday after quite a long battle with cancer, and he fought it awful hard, but sounds like he was ready and had made his peace, and he was ready to go when he left us yesterday.
Tommy was a good guy. Where was Tommy living?
McDonald, Tennessee, right outside of Cleveland.
And, what had he been doing all these years, Bobby? Do you know?
He had retired. He ran if I'm not mistaken, it was a salvage business. He did that for about 20 years, and he'd been battling cancer the last several years. I needed to speak to Ronnie West, and I called. He actually died Tuesday morning, Michael. I called Ronnie Tuesday morning about 10 after 11, and Ronnie answered the phone, and Ronnie was standing in the room with him and handed him the phone, and I spoke to him. I got to talk to him a little bit, not much. He only said 3 or 4 words to me. He simply said, "Bobby, I'm going home," and he handed the phone back to Ronnie, And at 20 after 11, Ronnie called me and said he was gone.
I'll be dog.
So
Tommy was a good guy.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
Ronnie each other, I guess, most of their whole lives.
Oh yeah.
Both of them started with Bruce when they were teenagers.
They've been friends for years. He made Charlie Smith look like a heavyweight.
Yes, he did.
Back in the day, yeah.
Yes, he did.
You know, Tommy was a good referee.
Yes, he was. This was a good referee.
I hate to hear that.
But that's
pretty strong. Five right quick, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Y'all think good thoughts tomorrow. I got to go to Tennessee and do that funeral tomorrow.
Are you really?
Yeah. And the funeral's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. So.
And I've never heard of that.
Well, I've done a couple in Tennessee over the years, and what I was told was this is something that started years ago. The farmers wouldn't come out of the field during the day to go to a funeral.
Well, I understand that.
Because they had to work their crops, but they would come at night. So they started having the funerals at night, and then they do the burial the next morning.
Well, that's the way they do it. That's the way they do it.
Yeah, and I thought about it today. It's rather ironic. How many shows did we work that started at 8 o'clock?
How many?
Yeah. So, you know, it's rather appropriate in this situation, I think.
It's a sad occasion, but I hope they pack the building tomorrow night.
Yeah, me too.
Time.
I know me, Randy, Charlie, Scrappy, and Gene Bennett are all going up from here, so...
Well, Jimmy Powell is going. Isn't Jimmy doing?
Me and Jimmy Powell, and I guess it was Tommy's minister up there. There's three of us that are having part in the service.
Well, Ronnie will be there. I talked to Ronnie yesterday, and he said that he was. Well, of course, as long as he knew Tommy, he was part of the family. He was there helping the family make arrangements and everything. So, it's a sad time. We all knew it was coming, but you know. You never prepared for it.
No.
How old was Tommy?
70. I had no clue he was that old. I had no clue he was 70 years old.
You're kidding me. Was he really?
Oh, yes.
I knew
in the early 80s, he was already 40 years old. And I didn't know. I mean, he was one of those guys because of his lack of hair on the top of his head, and he always had a fairly bushy beard. He always looked older than he was, you know, but I guess... He was actually as old as he was, not just looking that way. But I'd have never known he was. I would have placed him about 10 years younger than that. But, yeah, he started working for Nick Gulas as a referee in 61, I think I read, and he was like 13 years old. They started him early up there, see. I guess they don't have any child labor laws in the Nick Gulas office.
Literally not.
But we had originally planned our guest this evening was supposed to be your old tag team partner, Jerry, Ronnie Garvin. I talked to Ronnie over the weekend, and he was going to do it. And I called him yesterday. He said, "Well, call me Wednesday and remind me about it and everything." So I called him yesterday. He said, "Oh man, I forgot. I'm going to the mountain." So we're going to try and get him on next week and the week after, but he definitely wants to do the show with us. So we're
That's good. That.
But we do have a very good, and I don't want to call him a stand-in, because this was a show I had actually planned for a future date anyway, but luckily our guest was able to join us this evening on such short notice, and that's Minnesota historian George Shire. So he will be joining us here in just a minute, but... Before I get him on the line with us, we're going to take a commercial break. Was there anything else you guys wanted to...
Well, I just wanted to, maybe before you call him when we come back, let's talk a little bit about the reunion that Jerry missed. Maybe we can shame him into coming next year.
Yeah, well, I was told to rib him about it by somebody. But anyway, let me get...
All right, let me hear it when we come back.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Red Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main event at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Champions of Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling at the Academy Theater in Avondale State. We're also at the Masquerade every month or so. Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Champions of Wrestling. And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire,
formerly known as Platinum Champions of Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
Waiting for Freddie Miller to come in on that one.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that in a while.
we gotta record a Jerry Oates Natural Products commercial and run on there.
Let Bobby do it. He cut the promo for us.
Bobby used to do the promo. I remember hearing Bobby doing the. He never said be there, but I heard him run down the court a couple times.
I guarantee he slipped in a be there.
I did on the radio spots. We used to send up north. I bet you Freddie Miller. NBC picked that up as their catchphrase one year. I bet you Freddie went to his grave wishing he'd have copyrighted that.
Well, I got news for you. It's being used now.
Oh yeah,
a certain person with the circus who's not me.
Who would that be? Let me see.
Does he have a Tennessee accent?
Yeah, he does. I can't say anything. I've stolen Dusty's. I tell them they ought to get them some of this.
Whatever works, my boy.
Absolutely.
Whatever gets them through the door.
Two turnstiles. Well, we had I don't know, I never did hear an official count. I talked to Kelly, Bob Kelly, earlier this week, and the way they do things, you really can't get an actual head count because when everybody pays, they're allowed to bring one guest. But we had, I think he told me, 320-something paid, so half of them brought, spouses with them. We probably had upwards of 500 people in that building between Friday and Saturday. Now, they may not have all been there one time, but yeah, Jerry, you can't. Jerry Stubbs and Randy Alls were there, so you've got no more excuses. We can get the two of them down there. You've got to come.
That's a fact. Was Frankie King there?
Frankie was not there this year.
We had a few normal or the regulars were missing, but we had some new faces and we had some returnees that have been away for a couple of years.
Returnees or attorneys?
Returnees.
Well, the attorneys come in play after it's over. Les and his wife Alice was there this year. It's good to see him. Bob Armstrong and his wife was there on Saturday. Dennis Hall and his wife. Dennis Hall got the Man of the Year award this year, which I thought was very, very deserving. Goodness, who else was there, Michael? I'm trying to...
Roberto Soto was there.
Roberto came over, yep.
Garvin went back this year for the first time in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Who was that?
Ronnie Garvin. Tommy Sigler.
Was Colt there?
Tommy? What's that?
Buddy Colt?
No. Buddy hasn't been in several years now. Louis Tillett was back. I think Louis missed last year, but he was back this year.
How's he doing?
He'll be doing fine. I didn't get to spend much time with him, but he looked like he was having a good time and everything. Well, who else was there? There were so many people there.
Yeah, there was a bunch of folks there. Curtis Smith was there.
Root there.
Root didn't come this year.
No, Root. Bob hasn't been there a couple of years either. I think with his teaching and everything, it's hard for him to get away. I think he got a full-time teaching position. I know he was substituting for a long time, but I think he finally got a full-time teaching position. But wouldn't that be something? I wouldn't argue with him about doing my homework.
The sad part is the kids probably don't know who he is.
Exactly. Todd's missed this year because we originally were going to do the reunion on the second weekend, but then it conflicted with the race. It was going to be out there at the racetrack, so we moved it back to the first weekend, and Danny had booked something.
It was the NC2A's this weekend.
Yep. So he ended up not being able to be there, so Mac McMurray was safe the whole weekend.
Did you hear the story they told about the possum?
Possum.
Mac evidently found a dead possum up there where he lives. And he let it lay out in the sun a little bit, and then he wrapped it up in some sort of wrapping, and he mailed it to Danny and told Danny it was possum pate. Well, of course, when Danny opened it up out there, it was horror. You know, you can imagine what it smelled like. Well, Danny took it out in his backyard and let it lay out there about 3 months. And then he wrapped it back up and mailed it back to Mac and said he didn't care for it. He didn't want it to go to waste, so.
Man, the Postal Service is going to get under the jail.
I'm surprised the FBI is not after eating both of them.
Oh, goodness.
Send that stuff through the mail.
Can you imagine?
Oh, man.
That was the best one I've heard since the Nick Bockwinkel sending the watch to Charlie Smith. Years ago, Charlie asked Nick to get him a watch in Japan and send it to him.
I heard that story.
Yeah, it was awful. Wrapped it up in feminine hygiene products and put hot sauce and ketchup and just all sorts of stuff over it and put Limburger cheese in there with it and mailed it to him.
But I guarantee you, knowing Charlie, he took that watch right up to the sink, rinsed it off, and was probably wearing it.
He might not have gone to that extreme with it.
Or knowing Charlie, he may have sold it to one of his kids or something.
He could have.
Jeez.
Somebody, I can't remember. Somebody told the story on our show, and I spent the afternoon with Terry Latham today, and doing some stuff on with some of his pictures and stuff, and he told the story about Terry Gordy and Michael Hayes putting a dead possum in Buddy Roberts' bag, and it going several days. I couldn't remember who told that story. Was it you, Jerry, that told that
story?
Wasn't me.
Said
he left it somewhere. He rode somewhere with Watts and So they took the bag, and he left his gear and stuff with them, so he'd get it the next day or TV or whatever it was. But anyway, they put the dead possum was probably the cleanest thing they put in there. Let me put it that way.
Oh, geez. Hey, those guys, those you did not want to be around those guys. Period. When they were all three together, nah, you didn't want to be close. Because they were capable of anything. Oh, yeah. All in all, we actually had the weekend was very good. We had a great weekend, Jerry. Seriously, you need to plan on coming down. It's a fun time. It's well worth it.
Yeah, you need to bring your brother with you as well.
Yeah.
And his house caught on fire.
His house caught on fire.
Yeah, chimney.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Well, tell him you're supposed to keep the fire inside the chimney.
I don't know what that man did.
You got to get him cleaned out every once in a while.
He didn't find a dead Santa in there or anything, did he?
No, I don't know what he found in that thing.
Jeez.
That's his house up. I know he got a beautiful home.
Do much damage?
Bobby, the fire department did more damage than...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they had hardwood floors had to be replaced. Sheetrock had to be replaced. He said three fire trucks showed up.
Jeez.
You know, they'll dump some water on it.
Oh, yeah.
Just a mess.
I'm assuming with all that much damage, he lost quite a bit of personal stuff as well. Right?
Yeah, he really didn't go into all that. The most, you know, they had to put him up in a like extended stay place, you know, and just trying to live out of that was, you know, it's kind of rough. But it could have been worse, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
At least nobody got hurt.
That's the main thing. You can replace all that other stuff.
Yes, sir.
Did Bill Dromo make it, Bobby?
Yes, he did.
How's Bill doing?
Well, I'll just tell you like he tells me. Every time I ask him, including last Friday night when I saw him, how you feeling? He says, I feel like hell. He just, he's just a shadow of what he used to be as far as his outgoing personality, the way he cut up, and he would, none of that's there anymore.
Yeah.
He's just, he's on that oxygen 24/7, and his two of his daughters came down, and his wife, of course, was with him, and then one of his best friends is Danny Miller. Worked for many years, and Danny and his wife and daughter came up from, I think they live outside of Tampa. They came up and met him there, and of course they spent the weekend together. But it breaks your heart.
How's his Parkinson?
It was fairly decent over the weekend. I've seen it worse. I think it kind of comes and goes.
Yeah, I managed to get a chuckle out of him. I was standing there with Roberto Soto, and of course Bill was sitting down. Soto and I walked up, and I asked Soto, I said, do you remember him? And, of course, Soto was just joking. He said, no. I said, Bill, stand up and hit him. And he'll remember who you are, and Bill laughed. But I'm still afraid of him. I don't care how frail he gets and everything. I'm still afraid of Bill Romo.
Oh, you don't turn your back on him. He will still nail you. He will lay one on you.
Did Ole show up?
No.
What's the latest on his condition?
Pretty much confined to a wheelchair now.
You're kidding me.
Gets around very, very poorly.
You know, regardless of anything, you know, you look back and you remember guys, and you just find it hard to believe, don't you?
Here's a guy, and he said this himself, but it's very true. Here's a guy that never drank, never smoked, never used the first drug or pill of any kind. And look at the shape he's in.
you see, you cannot put a handle on that. I can't.
No.
You just, no, he never did. I never saw him smoke, drink, nothing. I mean, just, and you just wonder why. You just don't understand.
Well.
On the other end of the spectrum, you see Don Fargo, who's done everything he could possibly have done. He looks 20 years younger than he actually is, and other than a slight limp, he gets around.
Gets around great.
You just wonder sometimes, don't you? Should I just went ahead and had at it and hope for the best? I don't know. It's just a mind-boggling thing to me. But I hate to see Ole, I know that's tough. Him and Bill and God knows who else is in, bad.
That's true. Well, guys, I'm going to give George on the line with us here, so bear with me just a second. I've been away for 2 weeks. Let me make sure I remember how to work this thing. I did something right. It's raining.
Hello, this is George.
George!
Hello, sir.
How you doing?
Very good.
Fine. Got Bobby Simmons and Jerry Oates on the line with us as well.
Okay.
So let me give you a brief introduction here. Welcome to the show, Minnesota's Authority on Wrestling History, as well as the author of the book, Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling, Mr. George Shires. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael.
So, Jay, did you ever want to work in Minnesota, like in September, December?
Yes, I did. I really did. I don't know why I never got there. I really don't.
You've been a good fit in that territory.
I don't know why I didn't go.
I would imagine the weather would have kept me away. George, you were born and raised there.
That wouldn't have bothered me, really.
I guess not. You were in Kansas City for a while, so...
Yeah, up in Iowa and all that. I know it can't compare to, Minneapolis, but we ran into some bad weather out there. But, the weather out there, coming from Georgia, I mean, it really didn't bother me. I kind of enjoyed it myself. Of course, I don't know, living up there all my life, I don't know about that. But I wish I'd have made that run.
Michael, one of the things about Minnesota, everybody says, well, it's so cold all the time, but, we really do get a summer. But back in the day, Minnesota was a great, and the upper Midwest was a great territory for wrestling, because during the winter months, that's when the attendance soared and when the promotion put on the best cards, because during the summer, they didn't usually run. Because people were at their cabins and out on the lake and whatever. So winter months were good.
Well, I guess you kind of had a captive audience because there was nothing else really to do. And I guess, when did the Vikings start in Minneapolis?
1961.
So there was wrestling ahead of that by...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Wrestling was extremely huge. If you just use Minnesota alone, wrestling was always really big all through the 50s, even into the late 40s, but all through the 50s. And we used to run sometimes twice a week. Usually they'd run an auditorium show, which could hold anywhere from up to 10,000 people. And then they'd have a National Guard Armory show during the same week, and you could get a crowd in of about 3,000. So they did that for many years in the 50s, running twice a week.
That's unheard of, isn't it?
Well,
and
probably.
They ran Minneapolis and St. Paul separately, too. Didn't they? How far apart are they? I know they're called the Twin Cities, but how far apart are they as far as that goes?
Now, you're probably talking, the river is what separates us, the Mississippi River. And we're, Minneapolis and St. Paul, even though they're usually rivals with each other, I live on the eastern side of St. Paul, and I'm only about 15 miles from Minneapolis. So it's not a long haul at all. But usually in the 50s, Minneapolis and St. Paul were kind of run like rival promotions, even though they were both under the NWA jurisdiction or umbrella at the time. But they ran separately. Eddie Williams was the promoter in St. Paul, and he ran separate cards at that time from, in the 50s, Tony Stecker was the original promoter in the early 50s. Then later his son Dennis in the later 50s after Tony had passed away. And then by the end of the 50s, that's when Vern Gagne and Wally Carbo had basically purchased the territory from Dennis Stecker. And then by 1960, Vern started his own company, the AWA, the American Wrestling Alliance.
Now, he was pretty much a star from the get-go when he became a pro because of his football background and collegiate background there in Minneapolis, right?
Yeah, when he graduated from college, he had basically being Minnesota born, he played for the Minnesota Gophers at the University of Minnesota, and he was just a natural for wrestling after he had represented the Olympics, wrestling in the Olympics in 1948. So he was always the hometown boy, the local hero, and you know the one thing that he always stressed himself was, let's put some wrestling on the mat. And he wasn't as much into the showmanship that, you know, a lot of the stars relied on. But Vern wanted and always emphasized wrestling first, showmanship second. And that's what his whole territory was based on. And when you mentioned a moment ago about whether or not Jerry Oates had ever come into the territory and why he didn't, I had that same conversation with Bob Roop a couple of years back. And Bob would have been such a natural for our type of wrestling in Minnesota and throughout the AWA. But he didn't come here because of the weather. He had lived in Michigan. He said he'd had enough, so he was into the South, and that's where he wanted to stay. But he would have been a natural with his wrestling background, and that's what Vern always emphasized first was wrestling.
Yeah, Bob, would have been a perfect fit for there.
That's true. I mean, now, the whole situation with Omaha, because Omaha was somewhat of a separate territory, but did they use Vern's guys, or were they working in some sort of partnership or something like that?
Well, Omaha was a little bit different in the sense that they had their own TV, and a lot of times they would run their own storylines, their own angles. But Joe Dusick in Omaha, and before him, the name of the promoter is escaping me for a second before Dusick, but they would run some separate storylines using not only some of Vern's boys, but also some of the Central States talent from Geigel. And they were kind of unique in that you would see wrestlers there that you didn't see in Minneapolis. And sometimes that was a little frustrating. You know, that's where Mad Dog Vachon really first got his first big exposure, if you want to call it the AWA back then. But Dusick ran separate, and at times in the early 60s, he would even do what we refer to as these quick title changes, where he would change the world title, the AWA title, for 1 week or 2 weeks, basically to build up a rematch. And it was never acknowledged in Minneapolis or any of the AWA cities, but it was an Omaha change only. Really screwed things up when you're trying to do title histories, but it worked for Omaha. And that's just the way it was until about 1963, when the two titles were unified and basically stayed the same after that.
Prior to that, when he would do those quick switches, did Gagne not have a problem with that?
Well, you know, I don't know whether or not Vern had a problem with it or not, but one of the things was is that me, any fan living in Minneapolis, we were none the wiser because, you know, back in that day, we didn't know what happened in another town, even if it was, 100 miles away. And that was the luxury of the territorial system where promoters could, you know, really get away with this type of stuff. And fans didn't know, and when we watched our television, or you watched your television in your territory, you were glued to the TV and led to believe that it was exclusive to you and you didn't know what happened in the next town or the next territory, and it was that was the nice thing about it. So I don't think Vern minded in the respect that the promoters, probably the mindset back then was just that no one's going to know about it, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I guess so. Nobody had the forethought and thought enough that you know, somebody, you know, 40 years down the line would be interested in trying to put together a history on the title and how many times it changes. Oh, I totally understand what you're talking about. It's been frustrating for me with just the Gulf Coast territory.
Right.
To keep, you know, because, you know, they'd have one guy being a champion over in Dothan who wasn't recognized in the Mobile territory, and, you know, they didn't use the Gulf Coast title at all in the Mississippi, and it's crazy. But I know primarily in the 60s, even though Vern was a strong world heavyweight champion, I would say that I would think the AWA was probably just behind Charlotte as the strongest tag team territory, because they really stressed tag team, especially, or actually even going back in the 50s with the Kalmakoffs and Crusher and Bruiser and Henning and Race and all that, they really seemed to have a strong tag team territory. Like I said, just behind Charlotte, which Charlotte, you know,
I would agree with that. And you know, when you go back, one of the things that Vern, he was, I think he was wise in the respect that he realized that if himself as the world champion or whoever he had the belt on at the time was the champion, you could run a card with the champion, and you could also have a strong tag team main event in another city. A lot of times during the 60s, the AWA was running 2 and 3 shows a night in different cities, and so it really paid off. But strong tag team territory, man, when you talk about the 50s, and this was still under NWA umbrella, you know, you said the Kalmakoffs, and we had Joe and Guy Brunetti, and we had Reggie and Stan Lasowski, and the Smith brothers, who Al and John Smith, who later were Ivan and Soldat Gorky,
right.
And the Gallaghers, Mike and Doc Gallagher, Mitsu Arakawa and Kenji Shibuya. Mr. Moto was in the mix with those two guys, and Hard-Boiled Haggerty would be with a variety of partners. It was huge tag team territory in the 50s, and it really led right into the 60s. And then, you know, as Vern aged, you know, towards the end of the 60s, I think the emphasis was even more on tag team, because Vern, for the latter half of the 60s and into the early 70s, was wrestling less frequently. But the key thing there was, is even though he probably wasn't the whirlwind wrestler he'd been a decade earlier, it never failed to amaze me that when Vern was on a card, that the attendance was up by 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people. And that was the magic of it, that Vern's name held that type of marquee value. So even as late as 75, before he lost the title to Nick Bockwinkel, Vern could put him in the seats, and that was the good part of it. And, you know, Vern also brought so many great wrestlers into the business because of his, every year or two he'd run these training camps, and he'd take, you know, boy, I'll tell you what, he'd start out with a dozen, 15 guys out at his bar, or his farm out in Mound, Minnesota, and you know, all these guys that come in and say, I want to be a wrestler, they think it's easy. And the truth of the matter is, Vern used to just live, you know, kick the living daylights out of these guys, work the daylights out of them for 2-3 days, and he'd weed out the men from the boys real quick, and then he'd get down to having 2 or 3 guys that would, you know, go through the entire camp, which was usually about 6 months long, every day for 8 or 9 or 10 hours. And when the guys got done with the camp, then Vern would use them on his cards, usually as a enhancement talent to begin with. A lot of times then he would ship the guys out to another territory, another advantage of having a territorial system, where they could pick up experience. And, you know, guys like Gene Anderson, who I know you're familiar with, and Ole Anderson and Lars Anderson and Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, just some of the guys that were down in the South that obviously made humongous names for themselves. But Vern's talent roster of guys that he brought into the business. I had made a list a couple years ago when I was doing some research, and there were close to 200 wrestlers that he had either had a hand in training or he trained himself through these camps. And it's really kind of hard to picture the landscape of the business if you took out all these names, because in every territory of the country there was a Vern Gagne talent that was there and probably the headliner.
Some that you don't even think of, like Mike Boyette.
Oh, exactly.
You know, between Gagne and Eddie Sharkey, Mike Boyette, they got him in the business. And that's, you know, I tell that to people and they're amazed.
Well, and you look at
Boyette being the guy that lost all those matches for Watts back in the 80s. And I tell them there was a lot more Mike Boyette as far as a drawing ability than, if you didn't see him here in Mobile, you'd never believe it. But I'm telling you, he sold tickets here in Mobile.
And one of the things, too, that Vern would do is that there were guys that maybe had 6 months or a year of experience under their belts, but they really weren't going anywhere. So they would come in, they would work with Vern, and you know, Vern had such a talent roster back in the day. When you had guys like Ray Stevens and Nick Bockwinkel and Bobby Heenan and Mad Dog Vachon and, you know, Larry Hennig, you get some of these guys and you put them in the ring with guys like Don Morocco, who was, you know, very young and very green back in the very early 70s. But he came in here and he worked with Billy Robinson. We know what Morocco went on to do, you know, all over the country. And guys like Bob Windham, who became Blackjack Mulligan, he worked with, trained and worked with Vern for well over a year before he adopted the Mulligan persona. And, you know, what a name he became. And I mean, you know, there's just so many examples of people like that. Bulldog Bob Brown, a guy who never gets much credit from a lot of fans, but, you know, because he was a Central States staple for so many years and some of Canada. But he started out being trained by Vern Gagne, and he wrestled up here as Bill Green. And Vern, you know, Bob Brown did job work here, but you could see early on that he was a great talent, and he went on to great things in his career. So there's just a lot of names.
Yeah, it's amazing to me to see when you can find it, because it's fairly rare. You know, early 70s AWA stuff, and you look and there's the referee, and hey, that's Dennis Stamp.
Dennis Stamp was another one, yes.
You know, somebody like him. Snuka start there fairly early in his career, or work there fairly early in his career?
Snuka worked here in early 72, and he came in as a young tag team partner for Don Morocco. And Snuka wrestled as Lonnie Kealoha. And they were together for a while as kind of a mid-card tag team. They usually worked against guys like Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch in 72, early 73. And then Kealoha Snuka went on and became Jimmy Snuka. Another one that fits into that category would be Frankie Lane, who had experience when he came in, but Vern worked with him, and then he went on to some bigger things. So a lot of names. I mean, any name you throw out, you can probably trace them somehow back. Harley Race would be another good example. When Harley Race first came here in 1964, he'd had a few years under his belt. He had worked as Jack Long along with Johnny Long, and he had, you know, some minor success in some of the real small territories. But when he came here in 64, still very much in his early 20s, hooked up with Larry Hennig for the next 5 years, Hennig and Race, it would be hard to argue of the tag teams all around the country, you know, when you say, well, who was best tag team. I mean, it'd be hard to argue and take Hennig and Race off that list because they were so good and such a draw. And then Race in 1969 went on, and a couple years later he's NWA champion. So, you know, he got a lot of his early start. Him and Vern worked a lot of matches against each other.
Jerry, I know you spent a lot of time around Harley and stuff, especially when you were in and out of Kansas City. Did he ever talk about what it was like being with Hennigan back in those days?
No, to be honest, he never did. I don't know why, but he talked about it some, but you know, he didn't really elaborate on it.
Well, he stayed fairly close because I think they teamed up again. I want to say it was 74, 75 down in Florida when Harley was booking down there. He brought Henny in, and they teamed some down in Florida.
Yep. Harley Race was, he often said that the main problem with the team that he had with Hennig, and they are still friends to this very day. Anytime they get together here in Minnesota, you see them at any of the reunions, they're huddled together at the table. They stick pretty close together. But Hennig's major problem, if he had one at all, was that he didn't want to travel. And Hennig was so good, Larry Hennig was so good. I mean, talk about a guy on the mic that could, as a babyface, you could love him. As a heel, you could hate him. And he was great in the ring, great worker. And he just didn't want to travel. Larry wanted to stay close to home. And Harley was ready to move on by 1968, 69. And, you know, Harley said that if Larry would have wanted to travel, they could have stayed together because they blended so well together. And they wrestled in Australia for a little bit in 1966. In fact, they were the first IWA champions in Australia. And then they returned here to the AWA after that. But had some trips to Japan. In fact, in the early 80s, the very early 80s, they also teamed up in Japan for one of those tournaments that they held over there at the time.
Yeah, Larry Hennig was a very good talent, especially for somebody his size. He was so agile and was able to do a lot of stuff. There's a lot of names. I was just sitting here running through my head that while you were talking, there's so many names that pass through the AWA that a lot of people don't realize. I mean, most people think of Joe LaDuke as Tennessee, Florida. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
He made his name, but he spent quite a bit of time in Minneapolis as well.
Yep. In fact, he teamed up
Billy
with Larry Hennig.
Yeah, exactly. Graham and Kohl, you know, were there, what, close to 2 years?
Well, pretty good for 2 years. Superstar Graham, you know, and again, you talk about somebody who kind of got his start. You know, this is where he really got his first push and really went over big. Before that time, his body style, his manner, his mic style, everything would have been something that Vern probably wouldn't have went for, but Billy was really good at it. And Koloff was here for a good couple years. And, you know, matches against guys like Billy Robinson, Billy was good in the sense that he could probably make mincemeat out of anybody if he wanted to, and yet he could always make everyone look so good, too. And, you know, Billy worked with Vern on those training camps as well throughout the 70s. And a lot of the talent that came through or that, you know, came out of those training camps, I remember Playboy Buddy Rose, who passed away a couple years ago now, sadly. But when he was trained by Vern Gagne and Billy Robinson as Paul Pershman, his first matches, you know, here was a young kid just getting his start, and I swear to you, when you saw him wrestle, you saw a combination of Billy Robinson and Ray Stevens and Bobby Heenan and a little bit of Nick Bockwinkel, and Paul Pershman was so good at just kind of picking up a little bit from each of those guys. And that was another great thing about the territory system, when guys could go from territory to territory and take a little bit from each wrestler they worked with and kind of mold it into their own package and become a star for what, you know, they could offer. And Paul Pershman was one of those guys.
Yeah, and he carried that talent, too, as far as even when he got towards the end of his career, when he had ballooned up to over 300 pounds, there again, he was still so agile, could still take those crazy Ray Stevens-like bumps.
Oh, yeah.
And people couldn't understand how somebody that big And, you know, you see people nowadays who've only been groomed on, you know, what wrestling has been for the last 10, 15 years, and they look at somebody like Buddy Rose and say, you know, how could he ever get over, you know, he wasn't any good. I'm like, you're not looking deep enough. Look, this guy could work circles around all the Lex Lugers and the bodybuilder types. You know, granted, he looked like Santa Claus, but he, when it came to working and actually getting the match over, Buddy Rose was right up there with the top.
Well, and one of the things about Buddy Rose was that, you know, he grew up a fan of wrestling to start with, and it was really just a goal for him to get into the camp. And, you know, he worked really hard to do it. And, I mean, when you saw as he ballooned up, as you say, and you could still see him do that Ray Stevens or Bobby Heenan flip into the ropes. Ric Flair, you know, had his version of the flip into the turnbuckle and that sort of thing. But Buddy Rose did it as good as any of them. And, you know, another big guy who you just would never imagine could do the things that a big guy like him could do was Jerry Blackwell. When Jerry Blackwell came to the AWA, here was a guy who, you know, was well over 400 pounds and as out of shape as any human being could look to be inside of a wrestling ring, and he was giving standing drop kicks. And, you know, he worked with the talent that was here, like you know, Ricky Martel and the High Flyers, Greg Gagnon, Jim Brunzel, and Tito Santana, and against Hulk Hogan and Jesse Ventura, but Blackwell was so good for such a big guy, and again, just a heat machine when he got it all down on the mic and everything. I mean, man, the fans hated this guy, and he was so good at doing what he did.
Bobby will have to tell you the story. You know, Blackwell got his start in Georgia, of course, because that's where he was from.
Right.
But Bobby, tell him the story, Bobby, about him working on TV and falling out of the ring.
We were Channel 17 there in Atlanta, and he backed into the ropes, and he was so short that he somehow or another he got pushed back so that he was in a squatting position, and he was so short that his butt went over the bottom rope, his head slipped under the middle rope, and he fell all the way to the ground and landed on the back of his head.
Oh.
So I was referee, and whoever he was with in the ring, I pushed him back toward the other side of the ring, and I was afraid to go look. I thought he was either dead or knocked out.
Uh-huh.
So when I turned around to go start the count, he was already getting up. And he got back in the ring, and we finished the match. Well, the match was over, we come out of the ring, and the booker, Tom Ernesto, was standing just on the other side of the door as we went through. He said, boy, he said, I thought you was dead. And, you know, the country boy thing wasn't a gimmick with him. He was as country as cornbread. He said, Mr. Tom, he said, I've always been stout about the neck and shoulders. It wasn't no big deal.
Yep.
And that was the end of it.
Now,
Buddy guy made a lot of trips with him.
You mentioned Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel. They spent some time in Georgia, too. Jerry, were you there? Were you in camp there when the High Flyers went to Georgia?
No.
That
I don't know where we were.
That would have been a great matchup, you two against Gagne and Brunzel.
Nice guys. I refereed some of their matches when they were here.
One of the things that I hear so often, you know, from fans is that they never understood how Greg Gagne could get the push that he got. And, you know, Greg wasn't a big guy. He wasn't really built like maybe a lot of the wrestlers were. But Greg was one of those guys that he knew how to do a match, and he knew how to get it over, and he knew how to work so well. And Bockwinkel tells me more often than not, he said, anytime I worked a match with Greg Gagne, he said it was a night off. And anytime I've ever heard a wrestler say that, I guess I take that's the greatest compliment a guy can get. And Greg always told me, too, he said, you know, when he went through Vern's camp, he said, what people don't realize is that Vern pushed me, this is Greg talking, he says, Vern pushed me harder than he did the guys because he wasn't going to have me go out there and not be able to do what everyone else could do. And he said, even though I didn't have the size, every night of the week when I was in the ring, he said, I'd not only have guys testing me, but I had to continually prove that I could do what I was trained to do. And, you know, I always tell folks that of all the, I was never a babyface fan growing up, but of all of the matches I ever saw Greg Gagne in, I never saw him in a bad match. Greg always gave 110%, and it was always believable. And you always, as a fan, you could sit back and say, you know what, he could win this title tonight, or he could win this match tonight. And
Yeah. That's
what it was all about, making you believe.
Exactly.
So Greg was so good and just doesn't get the credit. And a lot of times it was just the fact that he was the promoter's son. And that was always, you know, I think that's tough for any second-generation wrestler.
Yeah, but there was a difference in say, somebody like he and Mike Graham as opposed to, you know, and I'm not picking on Gulas, but, you know, George Gulas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, George knew his father. He used the fact that his father was the promoter to his advantage, whereas with Vern Gagne and Eddie Graham, their kids, they were athletes before they got in the wrestling business. George, I mean, Mike was a power lifter, state champion in amateur wrestling, and Greg was a heck of a football player.
Right.
And so he had athletic backgrounds prior to getting into the wrestling business. So they were very believable. I mean, a lot of people say have the same knock against Mike Graham. Mike Graham, he was so short. The only reason he made it was because his dad was. Well, trust me, when I watched Mike Graham wrestle the first time I saw him, I had no clue that Eddie Graham was his father. I just thought this guy is a good wrestler.
Right.
You know, regardless of how small he is. Look at Tony Charles. Tony Charles was, you know, small. Of course, I grew up watching, you know, in the Gulf Coast territory where the majority of our guys were smaller guys, not only weight-wise, but fairly short. Ken Lucas was, you know, one of the biggest stars here, and Ken's, you know, like 5'7", 5'8". But it's what they did in the ring. I mean, Ted Oates is another one. Ted's what, Jerry, 5'9", 5'10"? Is that?
He says he's 5'11", so I don't know. I'll leave it at that.
That's, of course, that's with the 2 inches of the built up on the bottom of the boot.
Well, and you know, Michael, one of the things that I guess I've seen change so much in wrestling throughout the last 10, 15, 20 years, probably 20 years, is that, you know, the fans are conditioned a little bit differently today, too, in that if every wrestler isn't 6'5" and weighs 300 pounds and built like a Hulk Hogan, then they're no good or they can't work. And, you know, back in our day, back in my day, we had average-looking guys who it was what they did in the ring. And, you know, they didn't have to be built like a Hulk Hogan. You realize that on any given night it was believable that any wrestler could beat any other wrestler. And, again, like I said a moment ago, that's what the whole idea was, is to have the fans believe that and go home with that and want to come back and see it again.
Exactly. I mean, and the era we all grew up in and all were fans in, you know, if it wasn't cookie cutter. You had wrestlers with different looks and different sizes and different shapes, and, you know, they work differently. And that's the thing now that a lot of guys, you know, they all work the same or seem to. They all have the same type of spots they do and all that stuff. And, you know, you don't have, there's not room for, you know, like in this territory, you had Ken Lucas, who I mentioned earlier, who was a great mat wrestler, and then you had Ricky Gibson, who was a flyer, and then you had Flyboy Frazier, who was whatever Flyboy Frazier was. But there was room for all of them in this territory, and it all fit and it all worked. And that's what's, to me, that seems to be what's missing today. They all look alike to me, and they all work the same, and it's just, you know.
Well, that, when you say they all look alike, that was one of the observations that I had just a couple of weeks ago. I had turned on Monday Night Raw for a few minutes, and I saw a few of the guys that were being presented there. And I looked, and every one of them had the massive tattoos all over, and they all look alike, and yet some are supposedly faces and some are heels, and, you know, it's kind of hard to tell them apart. But, you know, one of the things about the territorial system, like you said, Vern really emphasized this. If Vern had one blonde wrestler on the card, he didn't want two. And he didn't want two masked men unless they were in a tag team. And, you know, you didn't want two cowboys, and you didn't want two Indian wrestlers. It was, everybody was individual. And it was easy, you know, I tell this to folks, it really was clear, it was black and white. You knew who the good guy was, and you knew who the bad guy was. And today, it's very clouded, and sadly, they seem to change sometimes within the course of the program, who's good and who's bad. And
well, like I said, they all wrestle the same. So
exactly.
Like somebody is using heel tactics versus, you know, somebody being a scientific wrestler, as they used to be called. Well, let's back up a little bit. You were talking about tag teams earlier. I know one tag team that you were familiar with and saw quite a bit of included Gary's brother-in-law, Vic Steinborn. Teaming there with Doug Gilbert. And the fact that Doug Gilbert was the flyer of that team is what made that team amazing. Since Vicky was known as a flyer everywhere he worked except there.
Well, and you know, when you talk about wrestlers having different styles, a moment ago we mentioned Hennig and Race, and yet, you know, on the surface they may have appeared to be somewhat alike. Larry was the bulk of the team. Harley Race was the bump taker. And together they made their team work. And in the case of Doug Gilbert and Dick Steinborn, Vern had spent about 6 months kind of pairing Doug Gilbert with various wrestlers, and it even teamed with him himself once or twice, and it was kind of like, let's try to find the right guy to mesh with Doug Gilbert. And I know Vern had wrestled Dick Steinborn outside of the AWA before Dick came here in 1962, and he brought Steinborn in, put him with Gilbert, and they were basically dubbed as Mr. High and Mr. Low. And Gilbert was the flyer, and you know, Steinborn was the mat guy. And you talk about a babyface team that really captured the imagination of the fans, and they were given a mega push for about 4 months, and then they were, you know, built up for a program with who then were the champions, Art and Stan Nielsen. They won the title, and then they were built up for the program with the Kelmicoffs. And even though they lost the title to them, they ran together. They had their program together for another 4 or 5 months before Steinborn left. But they were extremely popular and on, you know, many main events around the AWA.
I would love to have seen them. I mean, most people are more familiar with Doug Gilbert and from his Georgia days. Of course, he was quite a bit heavier by the time he came into Georgia as the professional.
Right.
But he still, again, like we were talking about Buddy Rose, he still, somebody that bulk and that size, was still doing head scissors, was still doing drop kicks, was still doing, you know, stuff off the ropes and stuff like that. It's amazing to me. Jody Hamilton was another. I don't know how much you ever got to see of the Assassins, but Jody Hamilton, even after he was up close to 300 pounds, was still able to do all that stuff.
Right.
He was an amazing thing. And I think that again goes back to, that's another thing that seems to, we're talking about the difference between heels and babyfaces nowadays. The best heels, in my opinion, were guys like Jody Hamilton, were guys like Bill Miller, who could wrestle.
Right.
The reason how they got their heat was when they started getting out wrestled was when they would do, you know, pull somebody's hair, or they would do, you know, whatever, a little thing to cheat. They didn't have to go through all this with, you know, getting juice on a guy all the time. Just little subtle things, you know, got over more than anything else. But a wrestling heel for me was always more believable and better. Buddy Colt was another one. You know,
Buddy Colt was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I saw Buddy Colt when he was wrestling in Omaha. I had made several trips to Omaha in those years, and Buddy Colt was wrestling there as Ron Reed. In fact, worked a lot with Doug Gilbert and Reggie Parks and guys like that. Another great team, by the way, Doug Gilbert and Reggie Parks.
Yes, they were.
They would rank right up there with the Steinborn-Gilbert team. And, you know, I actually saw Doug Gilbert even in the late 50s. He was teamed with his tag team brother,
Johnny
Gilbert, and that was Gilbert Sanchez. But I saw them in a tag team match in Minneapolis, and Doug was pretty young back in those days. I was, you know, I was only a young kid at the time, but, man, I was just amazed at how Doug was flying around the ring. And back in that era, that wasn't always what you saw. But Doug really did it well, and it just seemed like he never lost it, despite how big he got size-wise later on in the late 60s, early 70s, and, you know, as the professional.
Right. Jerry, did you ever work with Doug?
Many times. I love
Georgia.
Work. Georgia.
Okay. Well, he was a professional?
No, he was one of the Infernos.
That's right, he was. He and Smitty was a, you know, Curtis Smith was an Inferno. I'd totally forgotten about that. You know,
Doug went on to have a lot of different personas.
Yeah, first of all, I had seen him in Georgia as the professional, but then I saw him in Florida in 72, somewhere around there. He was Anna Clark, the Red Team. And I never realized it was him until I saw him work. Because he was quite a bit heavier, and he had the big hair and the beard and everything, but was still a tremendous worker. Yeah, he just seemed to, his career just seemed to come to an end. I know the last major thing he did was probably in the mid-70s. He was up there with Vince Sr. They were calling him Gashauer Gilbert, and he just, after that, he just seemed to have walked away from the business.
Well, he did have one last run in Minneapolis in about 1978. He came back, and he'd actually lost a lot of weight by that time, and he worked some matches with Billy Robinson, tag matches. But that was basically the end of his career, and you're right, he just kind of faded out of the picture. And I know Mad Dog Vachon has told me that he does live in Omaha, or did live in Omaha, and pretty much just stays away from the business at this point.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that he was in Nebraska somewhere. That's a shame, because he was such, and again, you know, nowadays you mentioned Doug Gilbert, everybody thinks of Eddie Gilbert's younger brother, Doug Gilbert.
Right, right.
This was the first Doug Gilbert, Doug Lindsay.
Yeah, and he wrestled as Doug Lindsay early in his career as well, in the early 60s.
He never came through here. He was one of the few that never even spent any time in this territory. I mean, there were so many others that came through for a short time. One that was that worked on top here for, you know, most of the 70s that I know you're familiar with, because you saw him in Omaha, was in the AWA, was Jerry Miller, or Duke Miller, as he was here.
Yeah.
It totally blew my mind that somebody that was that good, because he was an absolute heat magnet here. He drew some tremendous houses here as a heel. But why nobody ever, you know, gave him a shot. But then there were so many guys in so many different territories.
Well, you know, one of the things that I guess I learned through the years, Michael, is that a guy like Jerry Miller, I think I told you one time that he worked as Jerry Hannigan for Vern, basically as an opening card guy or sometimes a TV guy. And he wrestled in Omaha, had some success in Omaha. In fact, he held the tag team title there with Greg Valentine when Greg was working as Johnny Valentine Jr. But, you know, guys that were Jerry Miller's caliber of wrestler, there were so many of them that hit Minneapolis, what we just refer to as the Minneapolis territory. And, you know, guys like Thunderbolt Patterson and Ox Baker and Tank Morgan and, I'll tell you, the list is really long of talent that came through here and didn't get any push here, but they'd go somewhere else and just be really, really big. And sometimes I just alluded that to the fact that, you know, not everybody in every territory can be on top. And
That's
sometimes
true.
They just wanted to come through and have work, too, you know.
Miller, once he hit here, he seemed to have found a home here, and he had just, he'd been gone from here probably 2 months when he was in Florida and was building a car wreck. But he was,
yeah.
He was just a tremendous talent. And there again, you know, he was one of those less is more type. He was kind of like Johnny Valentine, whereas he got heat getting into the ring, and just, he worked so slow. You know, he didn't do a whole lot of spectacular stuff. But what he did, he made it mean something.
Right.
It's just, there again, we say it all the time here, it's just a lost art. Everybody has to put themselves through chairs and tables and light bulbs. And Cloud Stibbs looks at him like, is that all you got? Well, guys, I'm dominating the conversation. You guys ask Dort some questions.
How is Vern doing now?
Vern, I saw him on January 29th. He was at an event that we had here in Minneapolis, and Greg and the family had brought Vern to the event. Vern is doing well physically, mentally. Sadly, he's not at home. He doesn't know anybody. He smiles a lot. But as Greg said, and Vern just celebrated on February 26th his 86th birthday. But as Greg tells me, he says, you know, he just had a physical here a couple months back, and physically, the doctors say the guy could live another 10, 15 years. But mentally, you know, Vern is just not there anymore, and that's the sad part of it. But you mentioned wrestling to him. I'll tell you this: you mentioned wrestling to him. And he does perk up, and, you know, he doesn't always remember any of the guys he's talking to. I know we had a few of the wrestlers that were at this event, and Vern didn't know who they were. But, you know, physically he's doing fine. And he's living with one of Greg's sisters and her husband. They do have a 24-hour nurse that watches Vern, and he does need, you know, that type of attention. So, it's been a rough few years for him, but physically he's fine.
Okay. I know I never worked for him, but I talked to him you know, I was the office manager for Jim Barnett for a number of years, and mm-hmm. I would talk to him on the phone, you know, getting him on the phone for Jim, and then I had a chance to actually meet him in Vegas a few years ago. I guess it was probably the last time he was there.
Okay.
Yeah, he was, I was curious. I knew... Of course, knew he had the incident at the nursing home, and
right.
You know, I was assuming that got. We didn't hear much more about it after we heard the initial reports, but just was.
Well, I can tell you that locally, that nursing home incident was, you know, bigger news here because of Vern's star status, if you want to call it that. I mean, Vern is a big name in Minnesota. You know, even non-wrestling fans, they've always known who Vern Gagne is. Because Vern has always been involved in charity events and amateur wrestling events and football events. I mean, he's always been around through the years. But that nursing home thing, it got blown out of proportion as to what really happened. And ironically, the day after it happened, Greg Gagne had come over to my house. And when he walked in, he was telling me the story about what had happened the day before, how he had to go get Vern out of the home because they were going to arrest him. And he told me the story. And, you know, basically it was the older guy that Vern got into the confrontation with was 93 years old, also in this Alzheimer's unit. And him and Vern just had a personality conflict, and Vern pushed him. And the guy fell to the floor, broke a hip, and went to the hospital, came back to the nursing home, and like a day or two later, this was around 2 weeks later, he died. And of course, that, you know, really brought attention to it. And I had people telling me, and it was on the news, that Vern had picked him up and body slammed him, and, you know, all different kinds of stories. But the truth of the matter was is it was a shoving contest. And, of course, being 93, the guy probably wasn't all that stable. And Vern, I'm going to tell you right now, Vern is still extremely strong. And that's part of the problem. And, you know, I think he probably goes into that wrestling mode. And so his push was probably more than what a normal 84-year-old or whatever he was at the time would have given. But it was blown out of proportion.
Okay.
And he's fine now. There were never any charges. The family of the other gentleman, they never pressed charges. They realized the situation. The only sad part of the whole thing is that no nursing home in Minnesota right now will take Vern Gagne because of the, I guess you'd say, the risk or the liability they don't want to have. And so this is the reason that Greg has Vern staying with his sister and her husband. And I know at this event we were at on January 29th of this year, they were all around Vern the whole time, and the whole idea was is that if he became disoriented or had issues, they were going to take him out right away. And the one afternoon, he was there 2 days, and the one afternoon, they just basically took him and left with him. And because he gets frustrated, he gets doesn't remember things. And so, and that's really sad.
Yeah. Well,
was that the what they were re-premiering the wrestler?
Yes. Okay. Yep, they had the 1974 Vern Gagne wrestler movie at one of our Minneapolis theaters, and Vern was there as a guest at both days. I'll tell you what, I watched him while he was watching the movie, and you could really see the delight on his face. And every once in a while, when, you know, he'd see himself in the ring or he'd see some action, you could kind of see him make the motions, you know, like moving his arms or... He really did get into it, but most of the guys that were there, he didn't know who they were. And, you know, like I said, that's a sad thing. You know, I will tell you too, Jerry, that Vern, as a promoter and a personality through the years, any guy, any wrestler that ever worked for Vern, you can get, for every wrestler you say that they didn't care working for Vern, you'll have two that'll say it was great. Vern was one of those guys. I bet you're familiar with Ole Anderson. And Vern's personality can be very much like Ole's, but as a promoter, as a guy who knew how to run a territory and do it so well in the day, anybody that worked for Vern, they wanted to work here, not only because it was a good territory, but the schedule was lighter, and they could always make good money. Vern was good on payouts, and you know, but he was tough to work with because it was his way or the highway sometimes. But
I always heard he ran a good territory.
He did.
I just hate I'm missing.
You should have gone up there. It's not too late.
I'm ready.
Not too late.
You can leave tomorrow on that little scooter of yours. You can probably be in Minnesota by April.
I'm leaving in my Prius and won't burn a tank of gas getting over there.
Well, and just for the record, for normal winters, this winter we've just experienced in Minnesota is probably one of the easiest we've ever had. We've only had about 20 inches of snow all year, and temperatures have been practically above normal all year. We're hitting the 50s now, and it's been a really, really good winter. Last winter, different story. We had 96 inches of snow, and it was cold all the time, so... This would have been a good one to be here.
I wish it was still there.
Well, isn't Greg, or at least he was last year about this time, wasn't he trying to do something as far as a school or a promotion up there?
Greg, yeah. In fact, I was doing some publicity stuff with him, and we had put some posters and different things together, but... he was trying to work with Buck Zumhoff and Jim Brunzell, and they actually did work with a couple of guys that are working on the Indy circuit. But the school itself, what really derailed it, and again, this is sad, when the whole Vern Gagne thing at the nursing home incident happened, it just took a lot of Greg's time and just got derailed from it, and it hasn't happened. But Greg has worked with a couple of guys. I know he worked with, Greg worked a lot with CM Punk, who is in the WWE, you know, before he made it big here. Greg worked a lot with him.
He's from Chicago, I think, Punk is, originally. So he probably, you know, I don't know how old he is, but probably he probably caught the tail end of the AWA.
Mm-hmm.
Which the AWA was still a strong territory. And, you know, people talk about, well, when Hogan left, of course, the majority of this is all from Hogan and people who have an agenda for making it seem like, you know, the AWA died the minute he walked out the door. But
that isn't
that's
true.
They had three or four good years, as good or better than the ones they had with him. You know, I think they really, just like everybody else, by 89 is when they really, really lost. And everybody talks about, well, it's because Vern didn't change with the times and all that. And, you know, he didn't have to. You know, it wouldn't have mattered what he had done. It was going to die anyway, no matter
right.
what he had done.
Well, and you know, when you talk about those good years after Hogan left, I mean, we had Hogan left here in 83 or the very beginning of 84, and we had well into 87, 88 when Vern was still drawing good houses, still had a good talent roster. I mean, heck, we had the Fabulous Ones, and we had the Road Warriors and the Freebirds, and, you know, a lot of other big names, Jack Mulligan, Archie Goldie the Stomper, and Mass Superstar was in here, and we had Kurt Hennig, and I mean the stars were really big well into the mid 80s. But then, you know, then the candle started to burn out a little bit as it became tougher and tougher to keep talent. And but you know, that I always tell people, I say, you know, this wasn't just happening to Vern, it was happening to Watts, it was happening in every territory around the country. When you started seeing Vince bringing the names in. But I can tell you this, for the first 2 to 3 years that Vince was running opposition to Vern with Hulk Hogan on Vince's cards, Vern was still outdrawing Vince's shows. And a lot of the time it was a lot of the AWA talent that was on Vince's shows, guys like Jesse Ventura and David Schultz and Hulk Hogan and some of those. But Vern was still, when they ran either a night or two apart, Vern still outdrew Vince. And to me, that was a testament to not only the fan base, but, you know, probably some loyalty, too, I don't know, by fans. But, you know, as it eventually took place, Vern, you know, he lost so much talent and, like everyone else, just couldn't put it together. And egos, everything else.
Yeah.
I've talked with Greg a lot through the years, and Greg, I think if Vern would have listened to Greg, Greg had a lot of ideas that probably could have extended it a little bit longer. But Vern was very stubborn, very old school in his thinking, and he wasn't going to change. And the truth be told, he actually did change quite a bit towards the end as far as what he was doing, as promoting and that sort of thing. But, you know, Greg was never going to buck his dad either. Greg is so loyal to Vern. To this day, it amazes me that, you know, Greg really, I don't think until Vern passes away will Greg totally open up. But he's remained loyal to his dad. And that's a credit, too, in its own way.
Absolutely.
Very much so.
Now, besides Vern Gagne, probably, in my opinion, as somebody who wasn't all that familiar with AWA except through magazines and what little bit of film I've managed to see, over the years it seems like the number two star right behind Gagne was the Crusher. I know, but he worked a little bit in Georgia. Bobby, were you? Did you ever?
I was in the office. I was never in the ring with him, but that's when I would had. I was told my services were needed elsewhere, so I was in the office. But yeah, I met him and was around him a little bit.
You know, I'll tell you guys about the Crusher. Yeah, you're right. He would probably be the number two guy. But and when you had him down in Georgia, I think that was 78 for about a year. You know, that was really towards the end of his career, and that wasn't the same Crusher that we had seen a decade earlier. But I can tell you this. I liked him as a heel in the early 60s. And you talk about, you look at guys like Stan Hansen and Bruiser Brody, the type of style they had, Gene Kaniski. This was what the Crusher was like as a heel. And he was so over as a heel. And then when they changed him into a babyface, he basically kept the same style for a couple of years, but then as time went on, he became more cartoonish, less work in the ring, relying more on the gimmicks to get through. But he was number two behind Vern, and the sad story there is that Crusher would take these little vacations where he just wanted to leave the ring for 2 or 3 months, and Vern would explain an injury angle or something like that, and of course it built up matches later on, but whenever the Crusher wasn't on our cards, attendance dropped, and when Crusher was on them, it was way back up. Ironically, Crusher could sometimes outdraw Vern Gagne, and that didn't set well with Vern, because Vern, his own ego was he was the star. And
right.
But it, sometimes he'd have to take a step backwards and say, I need the Crusher back, and he'd get him back into some storyline and bring him back in, and things were back to normal. The Crusher was way, way over, but very good as a heel. And I saw him way back in the 50s, too, as Reggie Lisowski, and I was very impressed with him then. But he was right behind Vern as far as popularity goes.
Now, was there? How did Bockwinkel? I know he held and Vern trusted him enough to carry the world title up there for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
How was he as far as drawing versus the way Gagne was as champion?
Bockwinkel drew very, very well, and part of the draw for Bockwinkel was the fact that he had Bobby Heenan with him. And together, they, you know, when they were defending the title, Nick could always put him in the seats, and Bobby certainly helped. Bobby Heenan was one of those managers that he was so good in the ring, even though he wasn't considered a wrestler. And Nick has told this story many times. He'd say, you know, if Ray Stevens or Nick Bockwinkel were announced in a particular city as being unable to appear and Bobby Heenan would take their place, be forced to take their place, the fans were more elated to see Bobby Heenan. But Heenan was very much the draw along with Nick. And Nick played such a different kind of a heel. You know, his mic style was very calm, collected, very seldom ever lost his temper and shouted, but he could irritate the fans by insulting them. You know, he'd come out and say something like, you know, you 8-5 White Sox lifers, and then he'd go on to some story, but he just was so good in the ring, and he was a wrestler in the sense that Vern wanted a wrestler to hold his belt. And he drew very well. Always on top, Nick did well.
But there again, I've only seen him as far as his matches while he was champion through film or videotape or whatever. And it doesn't seem like they beat the thing to death as far as he was constantly losing by disqualification because of Heenan interfering with what. And see, that to me is part of what killed the Sheik's, you know, gimmick. I mean, he lost every one of his matches by disqualification because
right.
of whoever his manager was Farouk or whoever. And Flair got into that same habit once he was no longer a touring champion and he was strictly working for the Crockett's or Turner. You know, you could just about see he's going to get killed in a match, and at the last minute he's going to get disqualified or somebody's going to interfere. And to me, Bockwinkel seemed to be a strong enough champion that he didn't have to rely on that.
Well, one of the things that Nick had, too, was he always garnered a great deal of respect from not only the wrestlers. Vern obviously trusted him. They were close friends. And, you know, Nick was able to go to other territories as well as a WA champion, defend his title, or at least work on the cards. I know he worked in Florida and Texas. Nick was just good, and he didn't lose by disqualification. If Heenan interfered, it usually was that the referee didn't see it, and Nick won the match, and there was no disqualification. And that even brings up more heat, because then, you know, the fans go home thinking, well, Billy Robinson could have won or should have won, and it was because of Heenan that he didn't.
And even that, they didn't do it to death.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
No. They were very good in each city. If they ran a program with guys, they were very good about doing different finishes for the matches that they had during the course of the program. And so very seldom as a fan did you see the same thing happen, or you've seen a consistent, if Nick wrestled four different opponents over the course of a year, did you see the same type of endings? They were very good about that. And I think Vern always emphasized that we're telling a different story for each match.
There again is something else is lost. I saw Bockwinkel for the first time in 73, I think it was. I used to live in Tampa in the summers.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Stevens were down there, and even though they were the AWA World Tag Team Champions, their schedule was so light in Minnesota that they were actually, for most of the summer, they were in Florida, and they were the Florida Tag Team Champions.
Right.
That was my first time to see either one of them. And what a tremendous team. Even though, you know, it seems like they were together for forever, they were together, what, off and on for maybe 3 years, 4 years?
They joined up in 72, and they were together until about the middle of 76. And then they broke them up when Stevens turned baby for a while and Nick was champ. So they played it up where Bobby Heenan was. Bobby Heenan had Nick as the world champ, and he had Lanza and Duncombe as the tag champs, and Stevens was kind of the fifth wheel, and he kept shoving Ray aside, and Ray got fed up with it, and you know, basically turned face for a while, wrestled against Nick. But, you know, they were another team that when you looked at their two styles, they were very different. You know, just like we mentioned with Hennig and Race and Gilbert and Steinborn, teams like that. Nick and Ray were very different, but together they just meshed and just made it so well. And, again, Ray Stevens, the bump taker in the darn team. I mean, man, Ray could come in and just put on a clinic for you with what he could do. And Nick basically was the wrestler, and they just worked well together.
And Stevens had the reputation, I mean, even to this day, if you talk to a lot of the guys that were of that era and ask them who the best bump taker was,
mm-hmm.
they'll all say Stevens was. I've heard it from Don Fargo. I heard it from Sputnik Monroe before he passed away. You know, but everything he did made sense.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't take a bump just for the sake of, you know, hey, look at me, watch me take this bump.
Right. Well, and Nick told me the story one time. He said, you know, the thing with Ray is that Ray was a party guy. He loved to have a good time. He loved to go out and just live it up. And he lived life to the fullest. And he was basically a kid in a man's body. But, you know, Ray could go out and party all night. He'd come to the ring with little or no sleep, and he could have been hungover. But when he stepped in that ring, he was on. He was so good. And Nick said, I always marveled at what he could do. And Wahoo McDaniel.
Well,
said he loved to work. Red Bastien loved to work with Ray Stevens.
Well, Stevens was a daredevil outside the ring. I mean, he raced motorcycles. He did.
Yep.
He did bronco riding, you know, and rodeo and stuff like that. He was just, you know, he was one of those guys that lived 48 hours for every 24 hours
yep.
a day.
Yep.
And I hate he passed away. I never got a chance to meet him. He passed away, I think, a year or two before I started coming to the reunions. He would come to the reunions in Mobile. He came quite frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby, you were going when he was there, right?
Yeah.
Did Bobby and Jerry, did you guys, I know you guys saw Bockwinkel because he spent some time in Georgia. Jerry, did you ever work against him wrestling?
Not Stevens, I did Bockwinkel.
You did Bockwinkel? Where did you wrestle Bockwinkel?
In Texas. Him
what
and
was like
Nick?
Yeah.
He was solid, I'll tell you that.
When Ray Stevens...
Was he as smooth as he looked as far as his rest is switching from holds and stuff like that? I mean, the guy looked
Stevens, they when I was in Texas, they came down there together. There's a California something. I forgot what they call themselves. What did they call themselves?
I don't know about Texas. I know they were down there about, 72? 73.
Yeah. They weren't there long.
Oh, I know. They were the California Comets, weren't they? Something like that?
California. They had California something written on their warm-ups. They wore purple warm-up suits.
Right.
Real good looking suits.
Well, and Nick Bockwinkel was good friends with Paul Bosch, so he would, anytime he could, he'd work Houston.
Right.
And I got to tell you guys, when Ray Stevens passed away in 1996, I had a chance to talk with Nick right after it happened, and you could hear Nick breaking up. You know, he really respected Ray, and it really affected him at that time that Ray passed. And I thought that was really unique as far as their friendship, because I'd seen them work together against each other, and I'd seen them work together as a team so much and so well. But Ray lived his life, and that's what Nick said. You know, he lived life like a kid and had fun, and he wouldn't have done it any other way if he'd have had the chance.
I'm sure he wouldn't have.
Now, but you mentioned Houston. Now, Stanley Blackburn, he was an attorney there in Houston, right? How did he figure into all the AWA stuff?
Basically,
I know he was the big head owner or president or whatever. But
yeah, basically, you hit it on the head, figurehead.
Okay.
Yeah, again, the luxury of the territory days and just having your local television being the outlet for your wrestling habit. Vern was always the guy behind the scenes putting the show on and pulling the strings. Wally Carbo, the promoter, you know, Vern's partner, he was the front guy. He was the mouthpiece. And, you know, Wally was such a great individual in the sense that if you ever knew Wally Carbo, all of the boys loved Wally. I mean, I've never heard anybody say a bad thing about him. And Wally was the peacemaker. When anyone would have an issue with Vern, Wally was the one that could step in and mend it. And Wally was the stumbling, kind of bumbling promoter on TV. He had a hard time getting his words out. But then they would bring in the figurehead president, Stanley Blackburn. And, you know, Stanley, as you said, was an attorney. He was a friend of Vern's. And when he would come into town, it'd basically be for him and Vern to go fishing or something like that. And oftentimes we'd have guys like Wilbur Snyder and Bill Miller and Joe Blanchard come in at the same time, and they would be on the fishing trip, you know, and Vern would utilize them for a one-night shot on a card or something, you know, and they were big names, so they always meant something when they were going against one of the local bullies at the time.
So as far as the actual territory, was it just Gagne and Carbo as far as ownership of it? Did anybody else have percentages whatsoever in
no.
the office there?
No. No, it was Vern and Wally bought out Dennis Stecker in about 1957 or early 58, and they stayed under the NWA until August of 60, when Vern basically created the AWA with the fictitious story that if Pat O'Connor, who was then the NWA champ, did not agree to meet Vern within a 90-day time frame, that title recognition would be stripped of Pat O'Connor and as NWA champ, and Vern would be champ. And there was never going to be a match, but it worked well for the fans, and Vern became the first AWA champ in August of 60.
You know, I've never understood, as big a star as Gagne was in the 50s, why the NWA never gave him a run at that. It couldn't have been, you know, anything between he and Sam Mustang, because they ended up, didn't Vern have a part of St. Louis at one point?
Yes, he did, in the early 80s, yep. I don't know this for sure, but kind of what I've heard through the years, the thing with Vern and the NWA was the story given was always that Vern was too small to be a world champion. But I've always felt that there was probably some friction with Lou Thesz, and Lou was a great guy. Vern and Lou were great friends, but I don't think Lou ever really wanted to have Vern go over him. And Vern's ego, he was going to be champ, and that's why, being in his own territory, it just made sense that he was going to, you know, take over. And the whole title thing, you know, really got confusing when you mentioned Omaha earlier. In 1958, when Edward Carpentier beat Lou Thesz in a disqualification match or something, and Omaha recognized Carp as champ. And that's where Vern won his first claim as world champion. He beat Carp, and then eventually, you know, became AWA champion in 60.
How many territories did Vern ever work outside of Minneapolis?
Before he took over as AWA champion, Vern worked in Texas. He worked on the East Coast. He worked Oklahoma. I've got matches from him in Florida. I've got his whole record. I actually put his whole results record together. And he did a lot of traveling during the 50s.
He was probably the biggest star Fred Kohler had in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The DuMont Network is what really helped, too, because we had guys like Dick the Bruiser and Vern Gagne and Gorgeous George, and Lou Thesz was big at the time. That DuMont Network out of Chicago was what showcased a lot of these guys.
And a thing that a lot of people don't realize, too, Vern Gagne was the NWA World Junior Heavyweight Champion in 1949, 50, somewhere in there, right after McGurk had to retire. Because McGurk had the title, he was like Hodge, he had the title for, you know, 10, 12 years, but then he had to retire because he was already blind in one eye, but he had an automobile accident that left him totally blind.
Mm-hmm.
So he retired, and they held a tournament, and Vern Gagne won that tournament. So he was the first NWA World Junior Heavyweight Champion after Leroy McGurk. A lot of people forget that fact about Gagne. And that was within his first year or two of turning.
Vern actually, he won the World Junior title, the NWA title, on November 13th of 1950 when he defeated Sonny Myers in a tournament final match. And
right.
He held the title for a year when he lost it to Danny McShane in Memphis.
And that's another thing that was odd. I know the AWA, I've heard it said, and I don't know for sure that that's a fact, but the AWA, besides creating it for Vern to be, you know, world champion, it was also a time when, you know, they were looking into, I think, S.G. Stauffer, Kaufheffer, or whatever his name was, it was the senator in Tennessee was wanting to, you know, look at antitrust stuff on the NWA.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that was, the NWA was kind of formed as a wink and a nod type thing to say, yeah, look, we really do have competition.
Right.
But,
no, and that it was done with their cooperation. That is very
right.
true. Yeah.
In fact, we were talking about the junior heavyweight title. Danny Hodge, and I don't know if any of the other ones, Savoldi or any of those as well, but I know Danny Hodge made a lot of title defenses, mainly against Eddie Sharker and Bob Boyer in the AWA territory.
He did during the 1960s, and they would never, you know, the unique thing about that any of the three major organization titles of the 60s, I don't ever recall them saying the AWA world champion Vern Gagne. It was always just the world champion Vern Gagne.
Right.
And when Danny Hodge would come in, he was always just the world junior heavyweight champion. He actually wrestled against Vern I still remember the match as a kid. You talk about a hold for a hold and just a great match. He wrestled against Vern in a main event in the 60s. But Eddie Sharkey and Bob Boyer were usually his two primary contenders.
Well, I just saw Bob Boyer this past weekend, and he looked fabulous.
he was another guy who worked, quite a few years for Vern, and usually in that lower to mid-card capacity. Sometimes he'd be with a tag partner on TV and lose a match or something like that. But when, you know, he went on to a lot of great things, not only as Boyer, but Bobby Bold Eagle.
Right, right. Yeah, he was down here for several years, late 60s, early 70s. And then he left here in, I want to say, 73, 74, when he went back. He's from Indianapolis originally.
Mm-hmm.
And he was back to Indianapolis working for the Bruiser, and that's when he became Bobby Bold Eagle.
Right.
And, of course, he teamed quite a bit with Billy Red Cloud, but then Bob Kelly, who was the booker down here for so many years, as well as the top babyface, in 75, September 75, he left this territory, and he moved back home to Louisville, which is where he was from, because to be with his mother, his stepfather had passed away, and he moved back to take care of his mother. But he was working for... He would work for Bruiser in Evansville and Indianapolis and places like that, and then he'd also work for Gulas in Louisville and Birmingham and places like that. But they teamed him with Bold Eagle quite a bit as a cowboy Indian team.
We had the similar situation when you talk about the cowboy Indian team. In the 60s, we had Billy Red Cloud and Cowboy Jack Lanza, and they were always popular. In fact, they were opponents for Hennig and Race and some of the other teams. Made a good team.
And
Jack Lanza, by the way, is another Gagne trainee.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Vern trained Jack Lanza in the early 60s, and Jack pretty much, you know, he was a Minneapolis boy, and he pretty much remained loyal to Vern right up to about the end, and then eventually went on to work for Vince McMahon.
Another Cowboy Indian team. Watts and Wahoo teamed up some there in the 70s, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Yep, they were very popular together. And Watts was here. His first, his major run was between 1968 and 1969. He 67 is when he came in and got just kind of a mega push. Watts was very over as the top babyface. Had about four matches during the towards the end of his run here. He had about four matches in each city against Vern for the title. And although I can't speak for the other cities, I know in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Watts was always the you know, when you get two good guys against each other, the fans have to choose. And Vern would never play heel, but he'd just kind of be the subtle heel where he'd, you know,
right,
slap Watts in the face and kind of irritate him, and then Watts would, you know, and the fans would back Watts. So Watts was the sentimental favorite.
Hmm. Stone.
And that was right at the time when Watts left. In December of 69 was his last matches. Then he went down and worked with McGurk in Oklahoma and Mid-South area.
Vern at one point had points in McGurk's office too, didn't he, at some point?
Yeah, yeah, he did.
It's amazing that he had off points in all these other offices, but he wouldn't let anybody buy into his, which is smart on his end of it. I've always heard if everybody, if you added up all the people who had 10% of Florida, you ended up with about 314.
Yeah, well, Nick Bockwinkel had 10% of Houston, so he tells me. But, yeah, you're right. I've heard that story, too, where everybody had 10% of a territory, so nobody's got anything.
Well, that was true in Florida if you looked at the payoff.
Oh, Jerry, you're just bitter.
No, I love Florida. Loved it.
That was a very good territory in the 60s and 70s.
You're not kidding. What talent was down there? My goodness.
Again, there, and then Georgia, once Georgia got the cable, I mean, that's why you had, you know, people like, you know, Von Raschke came in, the Crusher came in, and, you know, guys that would need to leave their home territory for whatever reason. They always seemed to head to Georgia because they still had, they got the exposure on the cable.
Sure.
But there's another one, Von Raschke. I mean, he traveled all over the place, but he always wound up back in Minnesota for Vern.
Well, and you know, that was another story of Vern training Jim Raschke. And
right.
when Jim Raschke started out in the business, I'll tell you what, you never saw or heard a more boring, bland guy. Watching him in the ring and hearing him on the microphone as a babyface, but when he turned it on as a heel, you know, Mad Dog Vachon was a lot responsible for that. And when he became the Baron, just a whole different guy. And, yeah, he worked for the Sheik. He worked for Vince Sr., worked up in the Grand Prix area, worked in Texas. You know, Baron was over all over the place.
Well, guys, we're getting down to under 10 minutes. What's going on current in Minnesota?
Jordan, well, wrestling-wise, there's not a whole lot going on. Every once in a great moon, someone will put on a small independent card and, you know, draw a handful of people, and that's about it. And once a year, the WWE comes in, usually for one of their Monday Night Raw tapings. They usually have a full house. But otherwise, nothing. It's kind of just living on the memories for guys like me.
Huh. Is Kenny J still around up there?
He is. In fact, Kenny J is having he has an annual benefit for the disease histiocytosis. And it's a blood disorder that one of Kenny's grandsons had contracted. This is, I think, this year, March 31st. He's holding the 13th annual histiocytosis benefit. And what he does is he's going to have it at one of the local BFWs. He brings in, he always brings in Dick Beyer, Dr. X, the Destroyer. He brings him in. Dick comes in every year. Larry Hennig will be here. He brings in Nick Bockwinkel. Greg Gagne, Jim Brunzell are there. Buck Zumhoff, Stan Crusher Kowalski is there for it. And he puts on, has a big raffle, and the guys all come in and sign pictures and photographs and stuff, and all the benefits go to Kenny. And that's this. He's doing it this March 31st, and I'm going to be there and try to sell a few books. And last year they went over well, and then I donate some of it to histiocytosis as well. So, yeah, he's still around and just the greatest guy in the whole wide world.
Please tell him I said Gary Oak said hello.
I will do that.
I appreciate that.
Great. There's your opportunity, Gary. You can go work in the AWA at least for one night, even if
one
you
night.
Come on up on March 31st in Savage, Minnesota. Kenny's going to have his event, and you know, Kenny is. I'll tell you what, he was at this wrestler screening that we talked about earlier, the movie last month, and Kenny, when he was introduced to the crowd, Kenny just got the biggest ovation. And he is as popular as any of the guys. And, you know, Kenny, all he did was lose. But they loved him, they loved him, they loved him, and they still do. And, you know, just the greatest guy. He really is.
He was a nice guy.
And it was so funny, too, because at this event, the wrestler movie, he got up in front of everybody, and Vern and Greg were there. And I don't know if Vern knew who Kenny was or not, but... Kenny actually went to tears, and I'm not exaggerating on that, when he said he wanted to thank the Gagnes and the opportunity that he had to work all the years that he did and to get the attention that he has today. He says it's just the greatest thing in the whole world. Kenny runs a landscaping business and has for many years, so that's where the name Sodbuster came in. But, yeah, he is very popular and very liked.
Now that's good to hear, really.
I may have told Jerry and Mike this, but you were talking about Larry Henning when he was down in Florida. Gary Hart got me to go down and work Tampa TV, and they had me working with Larry Henning. Mm-hmm. It's the first time I'd ever met him, and he had this huge black eye. And, you know, I asked him, you know, how'd you get the black eye? Where did the shiner come from? And Harley started laughing. And the night before, they had been in West Palm, and a Mark had jumped in the ring. Actually, a couple of guys jumped in the ring. And Henning was sitting on the stage in West Palm with a towel in his hand, and he had a hockey puck in the towel.
Okay.
And he ran down to the ring, and he said his thought was he was going to go down there and take that towel and just swat these guys and knock them out. And people think, God, the guy's strong enough to hit somebody with a towel and knock them out. And they said the first time he swung the towel, the towel snapped, and the hockey puck came out backwards and hit him in the eye.
Yep. I'd actually heard that story.
Yep. Had a black eye with a hockey puck. Well, I worked with him the next day on Tampa TV. I saw him in Vegas, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago, and I shared that story with him. We shared a laugh together.
And Larry was, you know, always considered one of those tough guys. He was another Gagne trainee way back when. They had kind of a built-in storyline throughout their careers, you know, the old teacher and the student. And Larry took the roughhouse route, and Vern, of course, didn't agree with it. You know, it just made a great storyline. And Larry had, you know, he didn't need to travel because he had a good income here. And to his credit, Vern always took care of Larry, always had him near or at the top of every card, or, you know, in major programs. And, of course, Harley or Larry held the title, the tag title many times. And Vern always took care of him. So he was a hell of a talent, I'll tell you.
Well, let's get a plug in on your book, George. George wrote a book, what, 2 years ago now?
Yeah, it's coming up on 2 years, yeah.
And as one who has read it more than once, I highly recommend it. So tell the people where they can pick that up, George.
Well, thank you, Michael. And I guess the best place to get it at this point in time is go to Amazon.com. And you're going to get a cheaper price there because Amazon usually does that with the books. It is Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling, from Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors. And what I did with the book is did a chronological year-by-year rundown of all of the many, many, many great names that came through Minnesota, not just the AWA, but Minnesota way back from the 40s on. I really start with a history in the 30s and kind of show how it evolved, but chronologically, and then talk different things that happened. And in the sidebars, I give the real version why somebody wasn't in the territory anymore. And then at the last half of the book, I do a bio on some of the what I call the mainstays, the Crusher, Larry Hennig, some of the best tag teams, you know, Dr. X, and different guys just do a complete bio on their careers. And so Minnesota's golden age of wrestling, and had a lot of fun with it the last couple years. Been a lot of fun going to book signings and stuff, and everybody loves to talk wrestling, tell stories, and give us their rememberings. You know, it's a lot of fun.
Well, it's a very enjoyable book, and I highly recommend it, like I said. And George, I want to thank you for being our guest this evening. And
my pleasure.
We're definitely happy to get you on again. But before we go, I need to make a shout out, and I should have done this at the top of the show. Jerry, you mentioned a couple of weeks ago the gentleman that who's serving in the military that listens to us in Afghanistan. Well, I actually got a friend of mine who is from Pensacola originally, wrestled around this territory for quite a while, is in Guam, and he is a loyal listener to us. And his name's Chris Cody, and I just wanted to say hello to Chris and thank him for listening to us and keep yourself safe over there in Guam. He's a helicopter mechanic, and he's been over there. He just got his contract renewed, so he's doing well over there. But we missed him at the reunion this year, and really miss him being around because Chris is a great guy. We've had a lot of fun with him over the years. But anyway, that is our show this evening. George, again, thank you for being on with us. Bobby and
Thanks
Jerry.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
It's been fun, and we'll get together next week and see what kind of trouble we can get into.
I'm sure we'll get into some.
Sounds good.
Thank you,
man.
Jerry and Bob as well.
Thank you, George.
Take care, guys. Good night.
See you,
night,
guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.